Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. Today is June 3rd. I'm host Richard Benulli. Today we have returning guest Adam Rosenzweig of Gorozen and Ira Harris. Adam has been working focused on the Global Natural Resources Fund, partnered with Mr. Gehring at GNR. Prior to the firm, Adam worked in the investment banking department at Lehman Brothers. And Ira is independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003 and a stint most recently. And also we're able to share some charts graciously provided by Chief Investment Strategist Judd Hirschberg of White Wave Trading Strategies to help form the basis of some of the discussion. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. This is great. This is, again, a esteemed pleasure. The work of Adam and his partner are just unbelievable and gets a lot of discussion out there, which is more important than anything. So
yes,
thank you for that. And I'll add one thing just to your lovely introduction. It missed a 8-year stint at Chilton Investment Company, where I actually started working for Lee back in 2007 before we started GNR in 2016. So.
Oh, okay. That's great. Yeah. Great to know. Thank you so much. And if we could begin, Adam, with your macro view on the economy and financial markets in general.
Sure. Listen, you know, we're natural resource equity investors. And so obviously we have some views on macroeconomics and things like that. But I would caution anybody listening that, you know, we do try to stay in the weeds in the different commodity markets. And we're not, you know, we don't claim to be particular, you know, insights into the macro economy at large. But one thing I can tell you, which I think is a little bit of a different view than you'll hear reading Bloomberg or the Wall Street Journal, is that from the markets that we look at, demand remains and has remained very, very strong through most of 2023 and into 2024 on a global basis. I think that catches a lot of people off guard. The commodity markets, after a very strong 2021 and 2022, traded a little sideways in certain pockets last year and weak in other pockets. And a huge concern amongst investors was this impending Chinese property bubble implosion and a general economic malaise and recession that, of course, did not arrive last year and has not arrived so far this year, propped up by a lot of government spending here in the United States. But what I'll tell you is, whatever it is, it seems to be working from a demand perspective. We see very, very strong physical demand across the board. That's true in energy. It's true in copper. It's true in iron ore and steel and things like that as well. So we're not seeing the big slowdown and weakness that so many have expected. That doesn't mean we won't. There's certainly lots of things to worry about, I guess. But as of now, we're seeing really strong demand. And I should point out, it's really widespread. You know, so if you were to see a pocket of strength in, let's say, copper, and it wasn't being confirmed by strength in natural gas demand into the Asian basin or oil demand or what have you, that could be an anomaly. But the more markets seem to show strong demand in concert, I think the more likely you're seeing a true signal there and not just an anomaly. So we see strong demand, and I think that the economy is probably stronger than people expect.
Mm-hmm. That's good insight. Yeah, and your thoughts, Ira?
Well, you know, I'm just seeing this not in the depth that Adam and certainly Gordon Rosenzweig sees, but yeah, it's held up far better. And that's with the global macro backdrop, of course. There's, you know, as to paraphrase Mao, you know, with a single spark to start a prairie fire, there are lots of stacks of dry tinder out there that can burn. And we see them burning, but they're not having the impact in the way that we... in the way that we typically see them. So we go from one to the other, you know, of course, they're always with us, you know, whether we're going from the Horn of Africa or, of course, to we had the beginning of the Ukrainian war in 2022, and then we know October 7th in Israel and in Gaza. So those are ones, but there are so many, and yet the world just keeps, you know, pushing along, and then we get the Houthis in with their impact on shipping, which is an issue from a global macro perspective that really needs to be discussed, because why that continues to go about. But as Adam points out, we keep chugging along. And really, I think so much of the growth is in Asia. You know, everybody concentrates on China, and of course, China is an important story. But besides all those geopolitical factors, Adam is so right. We just keep moving along. So,
and I'm gonna add one thing, because I think it's quite interesting and germane, particularly with what gold has been doing recently. And it, you know, it has to do with all these large scale geopolitical shifts and things like that. You know, we're big students of market cycles and market history here. And commodity markets in particular, I think, are really, really a great ground to study cycles, because, and there's a whole variety of different reasons for that. It has to do, I think, with the fact that commodity prices are set on the marginal unit of supply and demand. So they can swing around much more than we see service prices swing around and things like that. You know, in the 17 years that I've been doing this, I've seen oil go from 45 to 150 to 27 to 87 to minus 45 to 120 to 60 to where it is today as we talk now, you know, down $2.50 at 75. And that market was never more than plus or minus 1 or 2% in surplus or deficit that whole time, right? So everything's set on this marginal unit. Prices swing around. And that leads to a lot of complications with making capital investment decisions. You know, how do you plan for that? What happens when oil prices stay at $100 for 5 years like they did, you know, following the GFC all the way to 2014? And then all of a sudden they fall to 27. You know, you obviously underwrite projects expecting higher oil and then run into trouble. And the fact that it takes so long for new supply to come online. So you have this really volatile price signal that whips around, and you have a long lead time on new supply. And because of that, what you usually ends up happening in an idealized cycle is that prices are high, it attracts investor capital, you have supernormal profits, and you bring on too much supply and everything collapses. So we've been studying these big cycles going back 130 and 140 years. Honestly, the price data for commodities goes back farther, but good price data for equity markets starts to get a little bit trickier to find, certainly in the United States, much beyond the middle part of the 19th century. But what we have seen is that there's periods of time where commodities become super expensive relative to financial assets, and period of time where they become radically undervalued. And all we do is we divide commodity prices by the Dow. You know, it's a really simple metric. It has all kinds of deficiencies. People that are in the weeds will tell me why it should be this and why it should be that. But it has a funny plus side, which is that it's a predictor that actually works quite well. And so it's withstood the test of time. And it actually, I think, is usually quite quite forward-looking and quite predictive. And one of the things that we noted all the way back in 2018 is, first of all, commodities have never been cheaper relative to financial assets. The energy sector, the S&P, has never been a lower weight than it is today, other than maybe last year and the year before that. But it's, you know, this cycle is an all-time low. And commodity prices relative to financial assets have never been cheaper. And one of the things that's so interesting is that when commodity prices, real asset prices, get so dislocated from paper assets, that tends to correspond with major shifts in global monetary systems. We saw it in the late 1920s, where commodities became radically undervalued by 1929 relative to financial assets. And that was the final end of the classic gold standard. We saw it again in 1968, when commodities became super, super cheap relative to financial assets. And that corresponded with the end of Bretton Woods. And then we saw it in the late 1990s, and that corresponded to the shift in the Asian central bank policies that we see today, where basically they peg their currencies below market rates to spur exports and suck treasury bills and other forms of U.S. financial instruments to the east. And so we've been saying for the last 5 years that we're in the right zip code for a major monetary shift. And I should point out that we're not people that have been calling for this for a decade. You know, people have said 10, 15 years ago that the U.S. has its house in disarray, it's receding from the world stage, on and on and on, political gridlock, so we should, you know, lose the reserve currency status. And all those things were true, but we didn't see any examples or any evidence whatsoever that we were losing the reserve currency status. And now that's beginning to shift very quickly. You're starting to see quite a bit of bilateral trade settled in renminbi. You're starting to see some major affronts on the U.S. dollar. Now, I'm not saying we're going to go back to a gold standard. I'm not saying that we're going to, you know, abandon U.S. hegemony, but we're in the right zip code for a shift. And I should point out, this might be a really kind of contrarian view, but after every one of those last shifts, you know, the U.S. did come back stronger than it did before. You know, you would think that if the U.S. went off gold in 71, that would lead to a end of the U.S. dominance on the world stage, and it became more of a reserve currency after than before. So I don't know what it spells, but I do think we're in that right moment in history for pretty major change. And I think when I look at the events taking place today, I would say, until shown otherwise, that they'll probably get worse and more disruptive as opposed to better.
Yeah, those are great points in historical perspective, Adam. Further to Ira's comments and your perspective just now, what are your thoughts on like geopolitical risks in investing in a multipolar world, especially in the commodities sector? Does it make sense to divide it between a Western world investor versus a global South investor?
Look, I think it's already been happening. It's certainly true when you look at Russian sanctioned, you know, crude and natural gas and things like that. It's definitely true when you start to consider the global uranium fuel cycle. And there's now been legislation passed through Congress and likely will be ratified by the Senate and signed into law at some point this year that would ban Russian uranium fuel imports. The only problem is that we don't really have the infrastructure to upgrade uranium into nuclear reactor fuel here. So we're, you know, frantically trying to build that out as we speak. But I think you're already starting to see, at least on the margin, you know, the idea that you're going to have a bifurcated, siloed world. We've heard talks of, you know, large trading houses where they've actually kind of set up, you know, Chinese walls between various groups that trade NATO commodities and non-NATO commodities. And I don't think that they necessarily have to just yet, but I think they're kind of trying to set up the right framework and infrastructure to be able to easily migrate. So, you know, when you go back and think about the fall of the Soviet Union and the bringing together of those two distinct commodity markets, that really had a depressing impact on price through most of the 1990s. You know, you got this big kind of tidal wave of supply coming out of the former Soviet Union. And so naively, I would think that if we started to, you know, balkanize the commodity trade again, which I think, again, it's not that it's quite happening just yet, but we're starting to see signs that it's beginning to, and indications are that that'll likely continue. I think that it'll create friction in the supply chain, and then ultimately we'll tighten that market. I mean, the other thing that it does kind of interestingly is, if you start to dislocate, you know, sanctioned commodities, presumably they would begin to trade at a discount, and then presumably they would be more attractive for big consumers. And so, you know, aggregate demand could increase. I've seen a lot of academics write about that and things like that. Whether that bears out remains to be seen.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Your thoughts, Sarah?
Oh, gosh. So much, you know, You look to see how this administration, of course, you know, we jump to sanctions. It seems they get sanctions happy. And even, you know, and a lot of the criticism on the sanctions actually comes from the quote unquote progressive left. The Center for Economic and Policy Research, which I often cite because I like to read their stuff, Dean Baker and Mark Weisbrot, and they've looked at sanctions for, you know, since Cuba, and who gets harmed and how they actually work. Everybody, you know, again, when you're looking for optics, you go, oh, these are great. Well, they haven't been great. And it's brought certain elements closer together. I know there's an article this week about some friction between China and Russia over the pipelines that are being developed to make Russian energy more available to China. But the sanctions, no, because so many of these, as Adam and their work certainly points out, you know, they're fungible. Yes, not oil. There's different grades of oil. Venezuelan oil is, of course, very heavy oil, and hence, you know, Citgo refineries were built to process the heavy Venezuelan oil owned by the PDVSA. But these things all have huge global ramifications, and they're not necessarily in the way that you think. And I'm always careful with sanctions, because sanctions are an act of war. Whether you want to admit to it or not, you know, and everybody, it's amazing how many experts there are on international law. And I laugh because I can't get 100 lawyers to ever agree what international law is. I can go back and read Grotius and, of course, Hans Kelsen, and I have a far better understanding, but everybody's an expert on international law. Well, to me, sanctions, when you go down that road of sanctions, you go down a very dangerous path. And again, they haven't worked. You haven't bankrupted Russia. Yeah, how many are you going to keep throwing on? And then, of course, they'll rise who you're really harming, because the people you're trying to affect aren't being affected whatsoever. But it does, for the short term, play a little bit of, cause a little bit of havoc, but not much, as we've seen. And that oil is going to make it onto the market regardless. Are oil prices going to soften? I don't, right now we're under a little bit of pressure, but there's some sense that people think that the global economy is in a slowdown mode. Maybe certain aspects of it, but as Adam points out, no, it keeps churning on and churning on. The geopolitical, again, we'll get deeper into it. And you're start, you know, but there's so much friction. And, you know, we can go back to Macron's interview with Politico when he was leaving after he, on the plane back from China in April, I think it was 2023, when he proclaimed that Europe would not be a vassal state to the U.S. And I think that weighs heavy on a lot of the decisions that are going to be made. And we had the Mexican elections and the Indian elections over the weekend. The Mexican election certainly was no surprise. I think the size of her victory is a little bit of a surprise. But now we got the European elections coming. And let's see, and the right in Europe seems to be doing very well. So let's see the way those play out. But again, more geopolitics, and how are they going to affect everything? So, you know, here's where it lies. The economy, global economy is still going on. And we haven't talked about China yet, but, you know, how is China going to play? There are a lot of those who are pushing that the Chinese are going to dump a lot of product on the world markets. But as Adam talks about with the global South, that's a whole different phenomenon in China's industry. The more you close them off to the developed world, the more their products will wind up at lower costs in the global South. So, and that's playing really into what Xi's plan was with the Belt and Road Initiative anyway, as we see it. So again, lots of things going on, but not in the way that people would think in their structured outcomes, because it would be seeing pressure here and here, and you're just not seeing that. And China, you know, the thing about sanctions is sanctions assume that those being sanctioned are going to have a static response. And the one thing is, the world's not going to wait for you. The world is not static. The way that Russia has fought in Ukraine has not been a static program. There's adjustments going on all the time. And I think that we who analyze the global world, especially the global macro world, have to search out and seek those adjustments to get ahead of them and look for investable opportunities ahead of those adjustments. But the one thing you're going to be certain is that the world is far more dynamic than the model builders want to believe.
What are your thoughts, Adam, on the precious metals markets in terms of a factor being driven by sanctions?
Well, I think very clearly, as I said before, I think that what we're starting to see is a bit of a fracture and a shift in the global monetary order. And I think that we are in the right zip code or neighborhood for that. And so a lot of people have said, okay, well, what does that look like? And Dyer's point, you know, markets and systems are far more complex than people appreciate and expect. And so the idea of trying to sit here in June 3rd, 2024 and exactly predict what the future global monetary system looks like is, you know, beyond the scope of this podcast or frankly any podcast. But what it does seem more likely is that gold takes on a more of a monetary role. And I think that that's happening for a couple of different reasons. You know, I think that whether you look to what China's trying to do with the BRIC countries and trying to move, you know, I think on SWIFT alone, 9% of commodity trade last year was settled outside of the dollar. And presumably, if your goal is to stay completely outside of the Western financial system, you might transact even more off of SWIFT than on SWIFT outside of the US dollar. but that's kind of one thing that's driving it. I think on the other hand, you see countries that just in general on the margin are looking to potentially diversify some of their US dollar holdings after the US has weaponized its currency several times. And whether they ought to have or not, or ought not to have, you know, time will tell. And there's certainly a lot of different opinions there, but regardless, they have. And I think countries are becoming concerned that, you know, that they might be next. And so even just on the margin, they're looking to potentially diversify away from their treasury holdings and into gold. So whether it's, you know, an outright change in how we conduct trade or whether it's a marginal shift away, central banks are buying huge amounts of gold, more than at any point really since gold was money. And to be clear, I don't think we're going back on a gold standard. I don't think that you'll have gold at the center of the monetary system and all the different currencies as proxies for gold and exchangeable into gold. But I do think that on the margin, governments are looking to potentially get away from the dollar and move more towards something that is outside of the financial system. You know, they say that gold is the only asset that's no one else's liability. And then people have tried to say that Bitcoin's the same. But obviously, if you're a central bank and you're looking to, you know, batten down the hatches, I don't think that Bitcoin is the way that you're going to look to do that. And you just see where it's happening. You know, it's happening, obviously, in China. It's happening in Brazil, which would be a big trading partner for commodities with China. It's happening in India. It's happening in Singapore, where they obviously feel that they'll be a major trading hub in the region. And so potentially would like to have both gold liquidity and then also, you know, just feel that probably in this new world, gold becomes more and more valuable. But if you look over the last 2 years, you know, the central bank buying is undeniable. It's well over 1,000 tons of gold at this point. It's accelerating in many countries. And it seems to be a trend that until shown otherwise is going to continue and frankly accelerate. And again, I think it's because we're in the right zip code for something like that to happen. So I think that that's a big driver here. You know, the next shoe to drop in the gold market, which will push gold quite a bit higher, is the fact that the Western investor and the Western speculator really is still selling gold. They're liquidating gold in response to high and rising real rates. You know, first it was rising real rates, then it was, you know, high real rates. And now it's the fact that all the big cuts that everyone, you know, 55 out of 55 Bloomberg economists predicted for this year now seem unlikely. And You know, who knows what next year will bring? And people are even talking about potential additional hikes, not cuts. So the Western knee-jerk reaction to that news is to sell gold and everything gold related. And amazingly, we still see that in the data, despite the rally, despite the all-time highs. If you look at the shares outstanding of the GLD, they've been shedding metal pretty consistently. If you look at the futures positionings as well, and if you look at, and this is the important one, I think, for investors, if you look at the shares outstanding of the gold stock ETFs, they've been liquidating. So the Western investor speculator is being completely consistent. And while I think is making a mistake in their own ways, being rational, they're selling gold in response to real rates increasing. However, the central banks have stepped in and they've completely overwhelmed the market, and they continue to. You know, we have not seen a single example of data being released on a quarterly basis by the World Gold Council that shows anything but a continued accumulation by the central banks. And I think, again, that'll continue. So in the gold market, you have the central banks buying and the Western speculators selling, and the banks are buying more than the speculators are selling. And so they've needed to coax that material from more price-sensitive sellers. And so gold's caught a bid and made an all-time high. In the gold equities market, the Western speculators selling, just like they're selling their gold bars. But of course, central banks buy gold bars and not gold shares. And so those assets have not caught a bid, not nearly to the same extent as the gold price, and now represent unbelievable value. So what's going to happen when the Western speculator comes back into the market and kind of bangs up against the central bank buying? I think that'll be the next leg of this gold bull market that'll take prices, you know, much higher, much faster than people realize. And then finally, momentum just comes back into the space. You know, I would say value, but I think that's like 20 years ago. You know, probably what gets the Western speculator and hedge fund pod trader excited now is not that it represents such great value, but rather that it starts to get positive momentum. And then, you know, you're kind of off to the races because there's a big air pocket in valuations above these stocks. So I think that that's a very bullish outlook for gold, the most bullish I can recall in the last several years.
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
And Corozen does great analysis on all commodities from an analysis perspective for demand, for supply, and the technologies. I'm just wondering your thoughts on the electric vehicle technologies and the renewable energy technologies, which ones make economic sense, which ones make financial sense and environmental sense?
Sure. Yeah, probably not going to like the answer. Not much. And the problem comes down, I think, in my estimation anyway, the main problem comes to how people view these technologies and how they really begin to think about them. And I'll talk about, you know, all the things people get wrong, but here's our framework. Okay. A source of energy, really the only thing that's important about a source of energy, if it's going to create energy, is how much energy it requires to make that energy. I mean, nobody really cares about electricity in and of itself. It's a means to an end, more so than anything else I can imagine, right? It's literally a means to an end. You use it to do productive work. And so if you have an electric system or any type of an energetic system, presumably one of the most important characteristics of that system is how much energy did you spend to get the energy out of the ground. And in fact, if you go back and you look, and people like Vaclav Smil have written really interesting, captivating books about this. So has Richard Rhodes on the history of energy. Like, who would have thought that that would be an interesting topic, but it's pretty fascinating. The history of batteries is also a really interesting story, which you would think would be pretty boring of, you know, Energizer versus Duracell, but it turns out it's all kinds of crazy characters and charlatans and scammers and, you know, unbelievable kind of anecdotes over the last couple hundred years. But anyway, I digress. When Smill and Rhodes look through the history of energy, it's undeniably one of moving from lower efficiency forms to higher efficiency forms. And that's unlocked the world that we know today. And it's created a lot of really interesting, you know, side stories along the way. Probably the most germane for this conversation is something that's known as Jevons paradox, where the idea was that Britain was running out of its coal seams right as the Industrial Revolution was taking off. And so the engineers got to work and they started to make these really efficient steam engines, much more efficient than the first generation. And everyone said, okay, fine, this will finally, you know, squash coal demand in England and will allow us to go for longer with the remaining seams that we have. And of course, just the opposite happened, because when you made this more efficient, you had this huge proliferation of the technology, right? Again, because efficiency was better. And so actually improving efficiency leads to increased demand, not decreased demand. I think any economics 101 student would know that, but somehow in energy policy that gets completely forgotten. But using that framework, it becomes really important to say, what's the energy return on investment of traditional sources of energy? And what's the energy return on investment of renewable sources of energy? And unfortunately for, you know, the green pundits, the EROI of renewable energy is much, 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 much worse than traditional energy. And it basically comes down to energy density. The idea that, you know, if you turned on your stove and put your hand over the burner, you would feel the density of that energy. And if you put your hand out in a really stiff breeze, even if the wind's blowing consistently, which of course it doesn't, it's just not the same magnitude. So if you want the same quantum of energy and the density is, you know, several hundred fold lower, then the only thing to do is to make the size of what you're doing big. And that's why windmills are big and they stand, you know, the size of 20, 30 story buildings. And that requires a lot of steel and it requires a lot of cement and it requires a lot of copper, and all that has to be mined and milled and processed and refined and transported and welded and ultimately installed. And so when you look at the amount of energy that gets produced relative to the amount of energy that goes into it, and this is before intermittency issues and battery backups, which only make things worse, of course, the EROI of a great wind farm is at best kind of 10 to 1. And at a gas well or an oil well, it's probably 60 to 1. And by the time you actually burn the gas and create the electricity, you're talking about 30 to 1. So a major, major difference. We've never backslid in human history, and we're not going to do it this time either. The reason that wind and solar has proliferated as much as it has been because we've had cheap, abundant energy last decade. I mean, we had two things really in the 2010s. We had cheap, abundant energy and cheap, abundant capital. And lo and behold, we've seen a proliferation of technologies that are wildly capital intensive and wildly energy intensive. And I don't think that's a coincidence. And I don't think it's any coincidence or surprise. And in fact, we did predict this before it happened, which is always harder to do than to predict it after it happened, that as energy prices and capital prices and the interest rates started to increase beginning in 2020, 2021, 2022, the biggest companies or industries that suffered from that was the renewable industry. And you've seen projects very quickly fall out of the money. And you've seen, you know, UK wind auctions where nobody bid on new concessions. And it's because if you normalize those things, these things just don't make sense. That energy efficiency issue comes to the fore. So what do you do about that? I mean, you can either make the wind blow an order of magnitude higher, but I don't think anyone would really like that when it's all said and done. Or you would need to somehow make all the materials needed not require any energy to make them. And, you know, we've been trying to do that for a long time, and I don't think that's really possible. In fact, we're moving in the wrong direction, right? As copper grades decrease, it takes more energy to make a pound of copper today than it did 5 years ago. So we're not moving in the right direction. Of course, it's never going to happen. On the electric vehicle side, the big problem is the battery. You know, if you think about an electric vehicle, about over half the total energy consumed in the life of the electric vehicle is consumed before it ever rolls off the lot. So yes, it's very efficient once you get the energy into that car. And that's why, you know, an electric motor is very efficient. That's why when you push down on the accelerator of a electric vehicle, it goes really quickly, because that part of the process is very, very efficient. You're getting all that energy delivered to the wheels almost immediately and with nearly 100% efficiency, about 90, compared to half of that for an internal combustion engine. But it takes a tremendous amount of energy to build that battery. And when you start to factor that in, the total energy to move someone 100 miles in an EV is much greater. And people are like, they're beginning to realize that. I'll give you a silly example and then I'll stop going on and on here. But when air travel and the jet age really started to displace ocean liner travel to go across the Atlantic, it only took like 5 or 6 years for their market share to reach like 85%. It was like overnight. And people might say, oh, it's because it was much more convenient. It's because it required like 20% of the energy that it would to move the similar person across the ocean via ocean liner. And so that's why you saw this mass adoption and proliferation like almost overnight. The next leg of efficiency in terms of time efficiency was put forward with the Concorde, but unfortunately the energy efficiency was terrible and it required nearly as much energy to go from New York to London on the Concorde than it would have back on the steamship, which is why it never was able to take off and never able to gain adoption. In fact, if you look back, I wouldn't be surprised if the same number of people on a percent basis traveled by Concorde than by ocean liner, which is basically a very, very bizarre subset of, investment bankers for the Concorde and probably ocean liner aficionados for the ocean liners. So until you can somehow improve the energy efficiency of the electric vehicle, which again, you're not going to do through the motors. They're already like 95%, but it's in the battery. And so there's some people that are working on things. There's some things that map out on paper that could work, but we have no real indication that technologically they're feasible to produce. Some signs of hope, we're watching them quite closely. But in general, that the battery industry is a very, very hard industry. I've seen really good companies with excellent technologies still not be able to make it through that. So I wouldn't hold my breath. You would need a battery breakthrough to make EVs go in the money from an energetic perspective. And until then, it's the internal combustion engine.
Yeah, that's great points. And you mentioned copper a few times. What are your thoughts on copper prices and the risks to copper from geopolitical risks? Like we just saw more of a leftist president get elected in Mexico. Could that affect, copper mining in Mexico, for example?
Yeah, look, I think from a geopolitical perspective, the thing that has everyone spooked in the copper markets last year was when the Panamanian government shut down Cobre Panama, which was like 5% of their GDP or something like that, some incredibly high number. And that was pandering to the environmental groups in Panama. I don't think the last chapter there's written. I have no idea what that last chapter will be. I've heard all kinds of different conspiracy theories, but I try to stay away from things like that. But, that's a huge world-class asset with, several hundred thousand tons of copper production per year, massive, massive mine that no one expected to come offline. And, you kind of joke that normally the standard operating procedure is that you expropriate the mine so that you then have all the money, but you don't shut it down. That's a new one. And so I think we are kind of in a little bit of a new world, given that, not only, leftist governments, I think, used to be synonymous with bringing assets and giving them back to the people. And now, with the environmental movement there, it might just end up being shutting them all together. I don't know. It's too early to tell whether that was the beginning of a trend or not, but certainly that caught everyone by surprise. Copper markets are really tight. We haven't invested enough in new copper mines in the last 10 years. You can look, obviously, there's a certain degree of predictability to copper production, although people get it wrong all the time. But, first you have to make a discovery, then you have to develop the asset, and then it comes on a production, and then you have depletion of the existing base. So depletion of the existing base is now really, really starting to bite. We're seeing that really all over, including Chile, most notably. Unexpected political disruptions like in Panama are now a thing. So the existing supply base is challenged. We have not made hardly any discoveries in the last 10 years. It's really quite shocking. You can see charts put out by all the consultants and you can see this kind of valley where there's just nothing. And so, we don't have a lot in the pantry to bring out now. Kamoa Kakula in the DRC was a big one. That's ramping up really, really well. They're going to probably, definitely add a major phase 3 or 4 expansion there. So that's going to be a new source of supply. Other areas, you know, Oyu Tolgoi underground in Mongolia. Incidentally, both of those projects were developed by the same mining executive, a guy named Robert Friedland. They're now talking about looking at big geological extensions of Kamoa Kakula in the Congo into their west, what they call their Western Forelands property. And, you know, if you kind of listen to what the geologists are talking about there, you know, they're really excited that could be a district. So, you know, that could bring on new supply, but it's not going to be this year or next year. That's for sure. Probably not lucky if it's 5 years from now. And so in the short, what we call the short term, which is like, let's say the next 5 years, it seems like a really, really tight copper market. Demand is growing. You know, everyone thinks that China's massively over-consuming copper. They're not. They have exactly the right amount of copper installed in their economy for an economy of that size. Everyone looks at the annual copper demand numbers, but copper doesn't get consumed. It gets installed into things. So if you look at the total installed copper base and you compare it to an economy of China's size, it's just where it should be. It's where every country's been at that size. You can't operate an economy, $12,000 of per capita GDP, with less copper than they have installed. And if they want to get out of the middle income trap, they're going to need more. Then India is where China was on every metric in 2003, except it's only installed about half the amount of copper that China did at that time. And that's why when you go to India, there's all these rolling brownouts. I mean, it's like, you know, at some point, I don't want to be flippant, but it's not rocket science. It's you go and they have ample electricity generating capacity, but they have rolling brownouts everywhere. And they've not installed nearly enough copper. And the copper goes into the electricity distribution, that last mile into the homes. Well, I mean, you know, it's no coincidence. And that's what they need to do. So they're catching up now furiously. And Chinese or Indian copper consumption last year grew by 30% year on year. Like numbers that if you don't think from the total installed perspective might seem ridiculous, but it's because they need to get this copper in the ground to get these distribution centers and these step down converters in place and ultimately get power to the rural areas of the country. Mm-hmm. So that's continuing. Indonesia is going through the same thing. You know, it's on and on and on. We measure what we call like the S-curve sweet spot, where when a country is really poor and it has economic growth, it has resource impacts, but the numbers are so small, it doesn't matter. And then when an economy or country is really rich, it can objectively grow its GDP, you know, moves more to services, and it grows its GDP consuming less commodities, which I always joke is a bit of a surprise, because to me, the quintessential service economy is, you know, Goldman Sachs managing director, and I've never seen anyone consume more energy to generate revenue than someone like that does. But the numbers do show that, you know, obviously as you get richer, you do kind of plateau. In the middle is the sweet spot. That's where, in fact, commodity demand outpaces GDP growth. And you can try to quantify that over time. And it's pretty consistent from between, you know, $4,000 to $20,000 of per capita GDP. That's the sweet spot. And typically, throughout the 20th century, we had 400 million people at any one time in that point. Some would fall off and some would enter. And today, you know, we have, depending on whether you run the metric for one country and everyone gets the same GDP per capita, whether you try to slice it and dice it, we have upwards of 3 billion people going through that. And, you know, not only is that unprecedented, it will also never happen again. You know, after this cohort is through, we just don't have enough people left to develop to ever, you know, refill that middle part of the S curve. But for right now, to the end of the kind of 2030s, I would suspect you're in this sweet spot where demand is just going to continue to surprise. And that's very true in energy. It's very true in copper. It's true in iron ore and steel. The only issue there is that those are a little earlier cycle. They plateau a little bit earlier. And China, which is a big, obviously, contributor to all of these analyses, they've consumed an awful lot of steel. So that's the only knock on steel, which is why we're less kind of bullish on iron ore. But, you know, when it comes to copper, that's definitely right in that sweet spot, and it's going to have a big tailwind to growth.
Great. And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, I mean, listen, Adam is so expert in these areas. So, and I know you've written about it before. So if we could talk a little bit about because you've talked about like the firms like Yeti, you know, following on Friedland's work, so that there are ways to increase the efficiency of mining and bring back older deposits that have been left as uneconomical. So we've seen firms, you know, and I'm familiar with Yeti because some guys who I do some investing with have been on top of that. This guy, John, has been very, very good with it. So I know you've written about that. And to read, to basically rebirth recoverable through new technology, recoverable copper assets. So you know, as long as we're talking in the investment world, where would you look for that?
No, there's a few technologies that are being advanced right now. And, you know, if you go back and you think about the oil industry and all the huge technological accomplishments that they've been able to bring to bear over the last, I mean, over the last 100 years and even over the last 20 years, you know, you can park a seventh generation semi-submersible drill ship in the middle of the ocean using satellites and thrusters, keep it still and motionless, and drill in 10,000 feet of water through 20,000 feet of subsurface, imaging the whole way through salt, which was always thought to be completely impossible to image through. And you can hit an oil pool, you know, and bring it on profitably. On the copper side of things, you know, if you unfroze exploration geologists from the late 19th century and put them on a modern crew today, after he figured out how to work the GPS, I think you'd be completely at home. Nothing's really changed. These guys still walk around the surface and say, oh, that rock's a different color than that rock. Maybe there's a mine here. And sometimes they get right. That's beginning to change now. And again, Mr. Friedland is largely in the center of it, but there's other companies doing other interesting technologies too. And he's not involved with Yeti or Yeti. He has his own set of technologies, but you know, they're bringing all this new technology to bear for the first time in a very long time in the mining industry. Some of it's on the exploration side where they now have new tools to image much deeper with much greater clarity. And we're seeing already some really good results there where, you know, Ivanhoe Electric has this new technology. In fact, they have the perpetual license on it, and they can go and look in Arizona and Utah, two massive historic copper districts that have been ostensibly picked over for 60 years. And they, you know, they're not through the development phase, certainly. And we don't even know, you know, it's not even through the full studying phase, but it looks as though they have potential world-class deposits in both sitting right there. Why? Because it's a little bit deeper than we were able to image. You know, now you can image as deep as you want using these new pulsed power technologies brought out by Ivanhoe Electric and iPulse. And, you know, what's it going to show? You know, what's it going to show in all kinds of areas that either prospective or what is thought to be fully developed copper districts? I think the answer is quite a bit. There's also technologies to break and crush rock, again, developed by iPulse, which is owned by Friedland and others based in France, although I think they're moving to the United States now. And, you know, believe it or not, on a global basis, we consume 4% of the world's primary energy crushing big rocks into little rocks. And there's ways to do it that are far less energy intensive, up to 90% less, using these pulses of power. And no one's really been able to figure it out, but they have. And I've been to see in their facility, and they can, you know, you dump a basket of rocks into the hopper at the top, and it basically has an iPad battery connected to it, and it comes out looking like the consistency of toothpaste at the bottom. You know, it's incredible stuff. And if you start to bring that to bear, now all of a sudden, all this low-grade sulfide material that's in the hanging walls and foot walls of all the mines that are in the stope faces and in the pit walls, you know, all of a sudden that becomes economic, because the only thing stopping you from producing that copper is that it's low grade and the energy needed to liberate the copper by crushing it and grinding it and floating it is too high. Then you have things like Yeti, and there's a couple other ones that are trying to crack the code, so to speak, of leaching low-grade sulfide material. So we can leach oxide material, but we don't have a real good way to leach low-grade sulfide material. If you could do that, we know where all these deposits are. And I should point out that there is a precedent in the copper industry, and certainly in other industries, where new technologies come and really do kind of change the supply-demand dynamic. I think what most people are probably most familiar with would be, you know, shale gas and shale oil, where we didn't have the technology to liberate that hydrocarbon. And then all of a sudden we kind of figured it out, and we brought on the equivalent of two Saudi Arabias in the United States in 10 years, and you know, depressed oil prices and gas prices and on and on. But the copper industry has its own, and that's known as SXEW, or solvent extraction electrowinnowing, which was a process brought about in the early 90s to extract oxide material. So basically, copper is formed in sulfide deposits. So there's sulfide mineralization that's associated with copper. If that then is near the surface and groundwater seeps through, that oxidizes, it rusts. And when we've explored for sulfide copper, we had this huge inventory of oxide copper. And the problem was you could never successfully process it, treat it, and liberate the copper. It was very expensive. And in the early 90s, technology brought about by General Mills, like the cereal company of all people, kind of cracked that code, and they could now all of a sudden leach that out using certain compounded chemicals, and then process that pregnant solution and electroplate it onto pure copper plates. And all of a sudden, you know, oxide copper went from zero to like 20% of world copper supply in a couple of years, and copper prices collapsed because of it. So, you know, new technologies can be fairly disruptive. We haven't had one since then in copper, and I think we are on the verge of several. So I don't think that that stops the bull market this year, next year, or the year after, but it's something to watch, and we try to stay ahead of these trends, and it's very, very exciting.
And just a final question. Go ahead, Ira.
So then going from there, because everybody, of course, is on the China is over bandwagon, and with the demand that we've seen that has remained consistent in the global economy, you know, this talk about devaluing the yuan isn't being in China's interest. But if, I find great umbrage with it, because if they were to do that, that would have a phenomenal negative impact on the development of the middle class, which they are doing. And I think Michael Pettis, who's been on with us to talk about this, has talked about. So with it, and if you're buying all these things that you need, because Xinjiang province doesn't contain every mineral in the world, although Stalin believed it did, and would have liked to have grabbed Xinjiang if he could. Do you think that it's in China's interest to weaken the renminbi at this, or the yuan at this time, or rather to strengthen it?
You're on mute.
I'm sorry, I'm muted. I think it's a very interesting question, and I don't think it's nearly as simple and straightforward as people would lay out, because of course China remains a huge importer of natural resources, and not only that, but it's the countries in the region do as well. And so when you look at kind of China's influence in the region and you look at their kind of broader strategies, I think it's very, very complicated. I think that China's energy dependence, which of course, China has now moved into the role the U.S. used to have as being the world's largest crude oil importer, makes it very difficult to do a lot of their, or to do what people in the West worry China would do, including invading Taiwan and things like that. There's still no real solution to how to meet their oil and crude demand and import demand if in fact, they were to escalate tensions in the region and things like that. So I think a lot of this comes to bear. I think that China is trying to work around some of that as best they can. I think that the big EV push, for instance, in China is less about being green, particularly since they're powering most of those EVs with cheap coal from their various coal provinces, but rather from being, more domestically secure and less reliant on global import markets. So, no, I think you're absolutely right. And I think, Marco Papik writes a lot about, geopolitical realities. Yeah. And like everyone, he's gotten things right and he's gotten things wrong. But I think his framework's a good one, which is that we often put way too much importance on kind of the cult of personality and too little importance on the geopolitic, realpolitik limitations that they face. And in China, there's certainly limitations. There's no two ways about it. And one is just how resource hungry that economy continues to be.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. And just a final question, if it's okay, on your if you could elaborate, please, on your bullish thesis for natural gas, especially at a North American perspective.
Sure. Look, when we started today, you said, "What do you want to talk about?" I said, "Let's talk about gas." And so we'll get about 90 seconds and right at the very end. But, you know, North American natural gas is the most asymmetric opportunity we've seen, you know, from a low of $1.45. Global gas is now trading at $11.50 into Europe. It's trading comparable prices into Asia. And today, you know, even after this big rally in US gas, you're at 260 from 158, you know, a couple weeks ago. That's just really cheap. It's way too cheap. It is the cheapest molecule of energy on planet Earth by some measures, 90%. And look, it has been for a long time. The US gas market has been dislocated from the world gas market since the shales came. But that's because the shales had this huge flood of new supply, and we had no ability to export at the time. And we tried our best that we could to switch coal to gas and build petrochem, but we couldn't consume all of the new gas that was coming. But that's a totally different picture, right? So the last time gas was this cheap on an energy equivalent basis was back in 2012. Well, in 2012, we were about to bring on 30 Bs of new supply. We had no LNG exports, and demand wasn't able to grow to meet that. Today, things are totally different. We're bringing on more LNG export capacity than we ever have in the next 18 months, starting now. They're commissioning the first trains today, and that does not stop. It's an unrelenting commissioning schedule between now and the end of 2027. And this is the big one. US gas supply has stopped growing. I have not seen this written anywhere, but the high watermark was made in November of 2023. Okay. And here we are. We got a report just out yesterday, or on Friday, I suppose, from the US Department of Energy that showed that in the month of March, US gas supply fell by something like 3 BCF a day. It was a huge number. In fact, it was such a big number that I wouldn't be surprised if April was a little bit of a rebound, right? But very clearly, the high watermark was made last November, last December, and now we're 4 months into declines. And when you look forward, you know, the government gives estimates for shale production in April, May, and June, because it's funny, everyone talks about gas being very short cycle, and it is compared to old traditional energy, but it still has like a 3 to 4 month kind of lead time, because you know when they're on drilling these horizontals and fracturing them. And so you can actually make a pretty good prediction kind of 2 to 3 months out as far as what supply will do. If you look at those projections through June, they're continuing to fall. When you look at the short-term energy outlook, which is the US Department of Energy's energy forecast, they are now projecting 2024 US dry gas supply to be down by 1%. They've never projected that in the past, as far as I know, you know, at least since the shales have come online. And that would require a 7 BCF a day drop from where we are today to the end of the year to hit those numbers. The US gas supply has rolled over. We're bringing on the largest slug of new LNG export capacity starting this December. And now you're talking about all the huge demands of AI on top of that, which are going to be largely gas driven, because you can't really run those on renewables. And I don't think we're going to build coal to power AI. So you have the best gas demand story we've ever seen in the United States, and supplies rolled over. And that is not appropriate with a $2 gas price, or $2.60 today, certainly not a $1.48 gas price. So where could it go? I mean, gas could easily reach the global parity, which, you know, net backs of liquefaction and transportation, you're talking like $10 here into the United States, maybe $9, against $2.60 today. I don't know of any commodity market that has that asymmetry over the next 9 months, right? It could happen very quickly. It is going to throw a huge wrench into geopolitics, because Europe has become addicted to US LNG, and most people are expecting that to come online. They're expecting the additional volumes, and they've counted on them. So if all of a sudden we have to now think about whether we want AI dominance or LNG export dominance, and if Europe has to think, do we want, you know, a NATO where our biggest energy exporter is starting to suffer some problems, or do we want to reconsider some of our positions? I mean, I do think that it's a pretty obscure market that really no one cares about that could have a huge amount of importance over the next 12 months.
Yeah, that's great insight points. And your thoughts, Sarah?
I can stop there. Adam and company do such great work on this. And I think, you know, people have missed some of it. And if you look across a broad spectrum, because again, it's all about from my perspective, and I believe Adam's too, is how do you invest in this? So, you know, searching out firms that will be able to avail themselves of it. And I think, you know, especially the issue with LNG, you know, years ago when they were developing the LNG terminals down in the Houston area, the Sabine Pass, and the huge amount of money went in, it was all dedicated money from Asian customers. I mean, so it was really long-term contractual agreements, but this is, as Adam points out, is changing fairly dramatically. And as for Europe, how's Europe going to continue to navigate this? It's going to be interesting. What's going to happen when they finally do come to some type of ceasefire and some type of agreement in the Ukrainian situation? Will they go back? Will Russia reassert itself in Europe? But of course, Russia is already making its own plans to move more to be China and Asian based. So there are going to be structural differences. It's always a demand for energy, because the world, no matter what you're doing, it is all comes down to, as Vaclav Smil is detailed out, and of course, in an ongoing way of investment based, as Gordon Rosenzweig has talked about, and Doomberg, you know, it's about how to avail this energy, you know, for potential profitable investments. And that's what we seek to look at. So, I mean, this is, Europe has made many missteps. I think the Japanese will see them slowly but surely turn those reactors on, and that'll change some of the dynamic. But, you know, here we go, and who's in the better situation is really going to be what it's all about. And of course, India coming on is going to be, you know, even much more of the story. So yes, the world is not Malthusian. It's much more entrepreneurial and capitalist in its nature, and they find ways to always increase energy demand, which brings on all types of new technologies and new types of investments, as we're seeing. And I think nobody captures this better than Gordon Rosenzweig from understanding it in that investment potential.
Yeah.
That's very kind. Thank you.
Yeah, no, it's well deserved. It doesn't take any effort, Adam, to give accolades where they truly belong. So yeah. Thank you. Good. Thank you for your work, and thank you guys for sharing it, because you do share it. For
those fascinating discussion. Yeah. Thank you so much for very interesting and insightful commentary and analysis, Adam. Thank you.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.